United States versus Tehran, if that's pronounced correctly, and others. Mr. Kendrick.
Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning. I'm Josh Kendrick on behalf of Mr. Josue Benitez, who is a co-defendant of Martin Tehran. Your Honor, there are a number of issues in this case. The four general areas that I'm here to address would be the text message threats that were admitted by the government against both defendants, the traffic stop that led to the finding of the murder weapon, the gang evidence that was introduced, and then the ATF forms that were introduced in rebuttal. I'd like to start with the text.
All your issues are evidentiary issues, then?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And all of them are reviewed for abuse of discretion?
That is correct, Your Honor. Your Honor, I'd like to start with the text message that were admitted. If you'll remember, during the trial, the government had a series of text messages to their main confidential informant, Mr. Sandoval, that they alleged were threats at the direction of Mr. Benitez and Mr. Tehran to convince him not to testify. There were a number of problems with the district court admitting those text messages. During the course of the trial, there was some confusion.
Make sure I understand. I just want to make sure I understand where we are in terms of what I'm looking at on this. If you win on this text message, he's not getting off this murder charge. Is that right? We're only talking about these threats.
Well, I disagree, Your Honor. There's several areas that these threats were used for. You'd be correct to, there were direct evidence of the witness intimidation counts that would be to the co-defendant, Mr. Tehran. But the threats were also introduced against both these clients as criminal intent. In other words, why would they be threatening a confidential informant who is testifying against them as murderers unless they were in fact guilty? So it was direct.
You really don't need to go there. I mean, we're talking a little shop here. I understand you got a job to do, but you're not going to get very far trying to say beyond the harmless error aspect of it when there's so much other evidence out there on these guys on the other charges. So, well, I mean, when we get down to it, it really looks like we're talking about the threats here. And he's not going to get out of prison off that little threat thing, is he?
Well, Your Honor, I being a wise lawyer, I think I'll move on based on what you've said.
No, don't move on. I just want to make sure I understand the context in which we're talking about here, because this guy has all these big charges, murder and everything, and we're talking about his threat. And I'm not saying that's not a serious charge, but I'm just saying, at the end of the day, even if we agree, you're just going to get rid of the threat.
Well, but, Your Honor, again, the evidence being admitted.
A threat against the witness is an indication of guilt to the underlying offense.
And, Your Honor, that's why
it's like running from the crime scene and threatening the witness that's going to testify against you. That's admissible to show guilt to the major offense here. It's a murder for hire. So it does come in against as to all these other things.
It's admissible, Your Honor, but it's.
But if it's wrong, incorrect to let it in or error to let it in, it then would have to be reviewed under some kind of harmless error doctrine, and there's a lot of other evidence here against your client.
I agree, Your Honor, but if you look at where a lot of this evidence came from, it came from Mr. Sandoval, the confidential informant, who was...
Yeah, but jury believed him.
Well, I agree with that, Your Honor.
Jury believed him. That's taken care of. We look at that evidence in the light most favorable to the government. So that confidential informant's testimony is golden in the context of this appeal.
Then these threats also, Your Honor, added to his credibility as a witness. And I think that's one of the other issues when a witness is threatened. That's why it would be admissible. Why would you threaten someone who didn't, in fact, know something? And I think that's exactly how the government framed this, that our confidential informant, who's adding this serious evidence to this
case. What makes the text message inadmissible?
Your Honor, the fact that there was absolutely no link between those messages and these defendants at all. There was never anything that would authenticate or make these relevant text messages. The government came in and said, we think they're threats because they came at some point a few days subsequent to a letter we intercepted that said, I've sent a message to the CI. And that was the extent of the evidence that linked them to these defendants. Your Honor, the government told the district court on a number of occasions where we don't have any way to tell where these messages came from, which of course has came out later in the trial. That actually wasn't true. It was very easy to determine where the messages came from, and I think that the reason that wasn't done was because we would have known they didn't come from these two clients, and that wouldn't have been there at all.
I guess my point at the offset was to say, I think maybe you might have a point on this authenticity business in terms of the text messages, and if it does, okay, threats goes away, but even with Judge King's observation that this is admissible, it seems to me that you're going to need to focus on some harmless error stuff here, because there's a whole lot of other stuff that support that murder for hire type evidence. You did not need this.
Well, but the majority of what supported that evidence...
And that's the point. I say that's where I would focus, but I'm just asking.
Absolutely. And the majority of the evidence, that, in my opinion, that came to support the murder for hire came from Mr. Sandoval, came from Mr. Sandoval saying, I observe these men setting up this contract that I know...
The authenticity challenge to the text message challenged Mr. Sandoval's credibility.
Because Mr. Sandoval...
All he said is, I got him. He didn't come in and tell you, he can give his own opinion where you think it come from, but he's not, his credibility isn't checked. He did, in fact, get him.
Well, but
that's not challenged, is it?
Well, no, that was the whole crux of the argument, that there were a number of people that probably could have sent that to him because he was an active confidential informant.
Right.
So there was just simply no reason to put these text messages in that were threats, which then turned around and made Mr. Sandoval look like his information must have been more valuable, why would our clients try to hamstring him. So that's really why I think this evidence is probably more important than it would seem, because of the underlying effect it had on Mr. Sandoval's credibility.
Without that evidence, no way the jury could have reached that verdict, then, right?
That would be my argument, Your Honor, that it had a substantial influence.
Straight face, I like that.
As straight as I could keep it, Your Honor. That it certainly had a substantial influence on Mr. Sandoval's credibility. Your Honor, seeing that I only have a short time left, I'll just quickly run through just some of the arguments. I think that maybe in the 30 seconds I have remaining, I'll talk about the gang evidence. This case had very little to do with gang membership. There was simply all the cases that this court and other circuits have considered where they allow gang membership would typically be a RICO, a Vicar case, where that association, in fact, is critical to the underlying case. Or there's times where the membership in a gang explains some outstanding element of the crime as far as ability to continue it, conspiracy among others. None of those existed in here, Your Honors. The evidence of gang membership really added nothing to the case, so it was absolutely not probative, but I think did cause some prejudice. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Milley?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Jonathan Milling, and I represent Mr. Turan in this consolidated appeal. The other issues that were not addressed by Mr. Kendrick, I'd like to address primarily the four different aspects of the case dealing with different statements which were allowed to be introduced. I'll begin with the destroyed statement of my client, Martin Turan. Early on in this process, Investigator Presto Giacomo from Lexington County traveled from South Carolina to Houston, Texas, and conducted interviews of Mr. Josue Benitez and Mr. Martin Turan. Both of these interviews were audio recorded. Mr. Benitez's recording was maintained and transcribed. However, Mr. Turan's recording was destroyed at some point in time between his leaving Houston, Texas, and us arriving at trial in South Carolina. As we've argued in our brief, the due process rights of my client Martin Turan were violated as a result of the destruction of that evidence. We've argued that Trombetta is the appropriate case to consider in looking at this evidence because the exculpatory value of the statement, based upon what we do know from Mr. Josue Benitez's statement, the process by which they elicited his testimony, the testimony of Mr. Agent Silva, the ICE agent in Houston, Texas, who was able to elicit certain statements by Mr. Benitez in his testimony. Both Investigator Presto Giacomo and Officer Silva both testified that they used the same type of process in interviewing these two witnesses. It was not simply a question and answer section. It was a true investigation where the officers would go to the witness, tell them, listen, we know that's not what happened. You got to take a step back. And that type of questioning is what we miss when not having the audio recording of that testimony or of that statement, because we cannot use that. And Trombetta doesn't say just if it's gone and it's exculpatory, it's a due process violation. We do have that second part that we've got to evaluate as to whether or not this can be duplicated from readily available means that what the problem that we've got in this particular case, and it's a problem that was not addressed in any of the other cases which have been cited by the government, is we've got a Hispanic-speaking client who provides the statement in Spanish. We've got an ICE agent, as we outlined in a different part of the brief, who was not an impartial interpreter. He was someone who was provided by the government who had a reason and a motive to clean his streets of what he perceived to be a threat or an MS-13 member. And he took no notes, as he outlined during his testimony, both at the pretrial hearing as well as during trial. Did not have any notes, did not have a specific recall of what the questions or the specific answers were. Instead, what he was doing is he was questioning the witness, and then we would have Investigator Presto Giacomo writing down in English what Investigator Silva said. So Presto Giacomo doesn't speak Spanish. He doesn't know what Mr. Turan was saying. We've got Investigator Silva, who was doing the interpreting, translating, what have you, but he has no notes, no specific recall of exactly what the questions were. And so we have no readily available means of reproducing this. Now, I recognize that the government is going to say, well, Mr. Turan could have and did actually testify in this case as to what the events were. And while that is an alternate, Mr. Turan was left with the requirement of having to choose between his Fifth Amendment rights of remaining silent or the due process rights as protected by Trombetta.
You won't get anywhere with that one, because I think once he testifies, you can't say that he was forced to testify, because you didn't get that evidence, can you?
Well, I think that we can certainly argue that, looking at how the trial progressed, that it had to weigh in his decision as to what he was going to do in exercising.
He was forced to get on the stand by the government's actions?
I think so, yes, sir.
You saying the government destroyed this stuff intentionally to keep you from being able to use it in defense of your client?
Well, Trombetta doesn't require that we show any bad faith.
Well, you don't say that. The judge didn't find that.
Correct, John.
You don't have that to support you.
Yes, sir. But I think that if we do look at the Arizona versus Youngblood prong of this type of a case, we don't have that they intentionally destroyed it. But if we go back and look, and I argued this in the reply brief, if we go back and look at what conduct they did undertake in an effort to try and recreate what this digital recording was, it was lax at best. We've got Investigator Presto Giacomo, who testifies, I read through the instruction manual and trying to find it on the digital recorder.
I mean, let me see where you're going with that. You said, yes. Youngblood, are you trying to now say there's a basis for bad faith on that part?
It seems as though
you do agree, or at least you don't contest this destruction was inadvertent.
I don't contest that the destruction itself was inadvertent, but I think that if you're looking at bad faith, you can also look at trying to recreate or trying to determine whether or not the government acted in good faith in trying to locate the evidence.
Well, that's the difference between destruction of evidence and in recreation or locating evidence. That's a whole different question.
Yes, sir.
And Youngblood deals with the destruction of evidence.
Yes, sir.
What's your remedy you're asking for now? You'd ask for a dismissal indictment.
Your Honor, initially we requested an either-or dismissal of the indictment. We think certainly because the officers testified as to what the content of the statements, that was in error. And we would submit that a remand would be appropriate, because the defendant's own testimony as to what...
Remand for a new trial?
Yes, sir.
That's what you want now?
Yes, sir.
You don't want a dismissal anymore?
We would love a dismissal.
We don't want it anymore. You gave that up, didn't you?
No, sir, Your Honor.
You're still asking for a dismissal, even though you admit it's inadvertent?
Yes, sir. I think under due process, the district court and this court also has the option of being able to fashion the appropriate remedy, which can be either dismissal or a remand.
Well, there are a lot of sanctions that you can take short of dismissal when you got intentional bad conduct on the part of the government.
Yes, sir.
The last thing you do is dismiss the charge.
Yes, sir.
The public interest is served by having the case resolved on the merit. Is that your best issue?
Your Honor, we've got other issues. I see that I'm
out. What's your best shot?
Best shot. Your Honor,
you're taking a shotgun approach. I'll agree with that. But and y'all have only touched on about 3 out of 13 issues. Tell me what, in your view, for your client, Mr. Turan, what's your very best issue?
Your Honor, I would submit that the strongest issue we've got was the improper use of Investigator Prestigiacomo's testimony in rebuttal in this case. He was the investigator who testified in rebuttal.
Admission of the rebuttal evidence.
Yes, sir. Right. And he was not in a position to be able to testify as to what the witness said, whether it was a prior consistent statement or a prior inconsistent statement.
The trial judge shouldn't have permitted him to testify.
Yes, sir.
And that we review for abuse of discretion.
Yes, sir, Your Honor. And we would submit that when you hear the testimony of a prior inconsistent statement, who was the wife of my client, Mr. Duran, when she allegedly testifies through Investigator Prestigiacomo that she observed the gun in Mr. Benitez's hand, that was what the rebuttal testimony was, that she overheard Mr. Benitez and Mr. Duran talking about what happened after the fact, that she testified, according to Investigator Prestigiacomo, that she was fearful of her safety, that if she cooperated with law enforcement, that she would get hurt. It's very compelling testimony for the jury to hear that. It certainly would not have been harmless error for that type of testimony to be elicited from our client's wife, Ms. Oriana, at this crux of this case, especially right in rebuttal once the defense has already submitted their case. We would submit that looking at the Martinez-Guyton standards that this course has adopted in the Badasik case, there are four different elements to look at. Certainly,
I just wanted to give you a chance to tell me what your best issue
yes, sir.
Was. You all saved from time.
Yes, sir.
Well, Mr. Kendrick has it. Mr. Richardson?
Thank you, Your Honor.
What's the government think about all this?
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge King, may it please the court. Excuse me. I'm going to focus on the issues that they focused on because I do think the shotgun approach makes it difficult for us to address all of those issues. And I'll start with Mr. Milling on behalf of Mr. Turan. With respect to the inadvertent loss of the digital audio recording, I think that Your Honors could look at the Matthews decision, a decision that both Judge King and Judge Gregory were part of, an unpublished decision that walks through the analysis in that case with respect to an inadvertently destroyed videotape and walks through exactly the analysis that was appropriately done by Judge Anderson here. There was no bad faith, and indeed it was at most mere negligence, which in the Matthews case this court explained is insufficient. There were alternatives available, just as in Matthews they talked about the testimony of Mr. Turan, which Mr. Turan actually gave here, as well as the cross-examination of the officers, which was available and which was actually used. That was discussed in the Matthews case and also expressly talked about in Trombetta in that same context. And this is also not the type of evidence that was known, and indeed the testimony below was the officer did not know and knew of no reason that that tape was actually exculpatory. And so we don't think that this is a case that raises concerns under Youngblood or Trombetta, and we think the Matthews case is a good way of analyzing that, and we certainly agree with the analysis that was taken there. To take the last issue, the best shot that Mr. Milling had, that is the in rebuttal, the defendant had offered the testimony of...
Keep in mind, that's what he thinks is the best shot, but we'll make that determination. You might want to pick the one you think they might have the best shot of.
Your Honor, I don't believe they have a very good shot on any of them. I'm happy to respond to any of them that you believe are...
No, you go ahead.
...are close to the mark. But I do think that with respect to the rebuttal testimony, which merely offered the prior inconsistent statements of Mr. Tran's wife, who they offered as an exculpatory witness, that the court reasonably applied the standards set forth in Vidic, which is the 2009 Fourth Circuit decision, and did not find that that narrow exception that Vidic set out, where there was a significant doubt about the accuracy of the translated confession, actually applied. We think that was a reasonable application and certainly not in any
sort
of error.
You normally use a prior inconsistent statement for impeachment.
And that's exactly what was done here, Your Honor.
But you put her on the stand, didn't you?
No, Your Honor. Mr. Turan called his wife in the defense case.
Okay.
She testified. On cross-examination, we asked her,
yeah,
you told the officers that you were afraid.
The
and then we called the officer. When she denied making those statements, we then introduced...
So the question was whether you were stuck with her answer, his answer. her answer.
Correct, which we certainly don't believe that we were. We were allowed to call the officer to show her prior inconsistent statement, which was relevant because, in fact, as is no great surprise, she was standing by her man. She was, you know, testifying on behalf of her husband. We think that went to her bias, and which is why her testimony was not to be believed, which is why we called that the witness. And I think it was entirely appropriate and applied correctly.
What about that? I was sort of thinking that the defendants might argue about that Miranda issue where they walked that guy through the airport, handcuffs, and got him to admit that he was a member of that MS-13 without giving him any Miranda rights.
Sure, that's...
And you all took the position he wasn't in custody.
Your Honor, what we took with the position, adopting the Fourth Circuit's position, of course, in the Conley case and the Cooper case, which was affirmed last year in principle by the Supreme Court in Howells versus Fields, that if an individual is in prison, in jail, then they are in a certain level of custody. That level of custody does not require Miranda warnings before a guard or a transporting officer engages in casual conversation with that individual. That's what Conley said. In the Conley case, they were transporting an inmate to the infirmary following a fight.
But he was already in prison.
That's correct.
In every case, they were already in prison, already adjudicated. Their status as a citizen was, that is custody. I mean, that life is custody. There's no change. You can't put someone in custody already in custody. But someone who is in a pretrial stage who's being transported, that's different, isn't it?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe that in an instance where Mr. Tran had been held for approximately a month in Houston on pending charges in Houston and then volunteered.
Not convicted, as every other case out there that you're talking about is one where you've actually been adjudicated, you've been convicted, you're in prison. Then when you're transporting a prisoner, there's no such thing as he has to be in custody, you know, because, you know, he's in prison.
So you
haven't done anything.
That's certainly correct. In the Cooper, Conley,
but
and...
this is different because you don't have an individual who has been convicted or is in prison. That's a different issue for us to decide.
And this fellow is being extradited, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. Absolutely, Your Honor. I readily concede that Cooper, Conley...
It makes sense when you think about it because, it, you know, intuitively anybody who's in handcuffs is in custody, you would think. But it makes sense for the court to say, if you're in prison, and you're in handcuffs going somewhere, we're not going to have this back and forth because you're already in prison. Doesn't matter. I mean, so your status hasn't changed. But for an individual who has not been put in prison, he's not been adjudicated, isn't that a different situation?
I don't think that I agree that the cases are different, but I don't think the principles, particularly that are set out in Howells versus Fields, but also in Cooper and Connolly, are any different in the context that we have here, where an individual has been in custody and will be remaining in custody pending the resolution of his case. What Cooper and Conley said is Miranda warnings are required where there's an added imposition on his freedom of movement or his freedom of action. And where an individual has been detained pending trial, that individual is similarly situated to someone who is in custody following a conviction. The conviction doesn't change the impositions on their freedom, that is, that they're always going to be in handcuffs. And the rationale set forward in Howells versus Field, I think, apply equally to detention prior to trial as they do detention after trial.
This is subject to harmless error.
It certainly is subject of harmless error, Your Honor. And there was,
talk a little bit about that to me.
With respect to his admission of membership in MS-13, that was one piece of evidence regarding his membership in the gang MS-13. There was evidence offered by Luis Sandoval to that exact same effect. There was evidence offered by Chad Moore to that exact same effect that Mr. Tran was a member of MS-13. And what the evidence, and sort of as this bleeds
so
into
the... surplusage anyhow.
It was, Your Honor. It was just an additional step.
Why does the government introduce such incendiary type issues like that, you know, gangs and, you know, why in a case that you now say is so strong and everything else is harmless error, why do you do that?
Well, Your Honor, we introduced it in this case because we thought it was important to show the cooperation and relationship between Mr. Tran and Benitez. Mr. Tran testified at trial that he did not know Benitez prior to the weekend that they committed the murder.
Now, which one was walking through the airport? Which one made?
Turan.
Turan made the statement. Okay, go ahead.
Turan made the statement. But we introduced the evidence of their membership in the gang to show that relationship and cooperation. And this is a Seventh Circuit case aptly named the United States versus King that addressed using membership in a gang. And this was membership in the gang without any of the negative connotations.
So you had no other evidence of their being together other than the gang affiliation?
Well, the only other evidence that was offered was that of Luis Sandoval.
Right, who overheard conversations.
Who overheard the conversations. And then immediately before they went to South Carolina, and Turan testified, before we went to South Carolina, I had never met that individual. And what I think in the King
but
case...
But does it matter if that was true, if strangers came together and agreed to go out and kill somebody, would it make any difference whether they knew each other 10 days ago or 10 years ago?
It wouldn't matter, Your Honor, but we do think it corroborates the notion that they were in cooperation and in a relationship, right? Individuals that don't know each other, I think, are less likely to enter into an agreement to commit a murder for hire. They lack the trust and the relationship to have that conversation. You wouldn't walk up on somebody on the side of the street and say, "Do you want to come help me execute a guy?" Instead, it's the type of relationships that are part of gangs that have codes of silence and conduct that enables this type of activity. And so that's why I think it was important. It also was intrinsic to the story, Your Honor. Back to Mr. Turan, Chad Moore's testimony was that Mr. Turan admitted his involvement in this activity to him, and in, before admitting it, he began his discussion with him by saying, "You know, I'm a member of MS-13. You don't have to be scared of me. I'm not telling you to be scared, but I'm a member of MS-13, and here's what happened." And so that's intrinsic. In order for Chad Moore to recount what was told to him, he needed to recount the whole story. And so that evidence, we think, under the Fourth Circuit's decision in Chin, it is intrinsic to the story, the testimony that Chad Moore was going to give.
It's in the context of the agreement.
Absolutely, Your Honor. So I do think in that context, this was really limited gang evidence. We didn't harbor on the issue. It was provided and it was sanitized. We didn't talk about the fact that they're, you know, the most violent gang in America. We didn't talk about the violence or those aspects about it.
Did the judge give him a cautionary instruction or anything on the gang stuff?
They did. He did. He described, and the exact details of which I can't recall, but I do believe that there was a cautionary instruction given. The judge was quite cautious, in fact, going through this, and you see in the various places that we cited in the appendix, of the judge's concern to make sure that the government was not overstepping in introducing inflammatory type information. The government certainly wasn't trying to do that, but the judge was also pushing back to make sure that we did not. We think that was appropriate in this context. To turn back to the initial issue that Mr. Kendrick began with and that Judge Wynn, you had several questions about, the issue of the text messages.
Tell me about that. I mean, bare bones, it looked like to me, Sandoval received a text message that was threatening.
That's correct.
Usually that's all you need. You don't need to tell where it came from. You don't need to know anything about this text message. But he just got a text message that threatened him, consistent with what the charges, I guess, is what you're saying, is. And you can introduce it.
Absolutely not. We would not agree that a text message just standing alone that he got with no other circumstantial evidence would be admissible. I absolutely agree with you, Your Honor.
But identify where the message came from?
Your Honor, we received these messages on the eve of trial, and when we got the messages, attempts were made to find out where the messages had come from. Indeed, Mr. Sandoval testified at trial that he did not know where they had come from. He didn't recognize the number. He had not had communications prior to that October 3rd threat with that individual. But in the course of receiving these and having a few other things going on, Your Honor, we did not take every possible investigative step to identify who the individual was, nor do I think identifying who the subscriber was would have actually been useful in this context.
But so someone could have just sent Sandoval, if they didn't like the defendant, just send him a bunch of text messages threatening him. Every one of them would be admissible, even though they didn't come from the defendant. I mean, if later on you found that out to be true, you would have introduced all these text messages that not a one of them came from the defendant, but they were using his trial. Your Honor, what is the purpose of 901 then? I don't get it.
If I can, I think please. This context, what the court has said is that the court, as an initial threshold matter, can look at the circumstantial evidence. And in this case, the key circumstantial evidence is this timeline. So on September the 30th, guards intercept a letter from Martin Turan to Josue Benitez. And it's written in code, hieroglyphics. If you look in the joint appendix, it's back there. It's written in code. And what that letter says, and Your Honor, this is at joint appendix 1959 and 1960, it says, and Turan talked to Benitez, I'm doing everything possible so that that explicative Luis, talking about Luis Sandoval, won't come testify against you. My attorney says he is the confidential informant and that his testimony is the one that can affect us. I already sent a message to Delmer and Oscar, his confederates, to take care of Luis. If they don't want to dance with us, referring to Delmer and Oscar, if they don't want to dance with us, we interpret that to be they don't want to end up getting convicted as well, and the party gets bigger, more defendants, they know they are the ones who stand to lose. That would not be in our best interest, but it's a way to put some fear into them. That's intercepted on the 30th.
So thereafter, any threat that Sandoval gets is going to be admitted because he says he's going to do something to it.
No matter what it is,
could be someone yells at him on the street. I'm going to kill you.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I agree with you that not every yell on the street, not something that happened months later. But then 3 days after that,
yes,
Luis Sandoval testifies for the first time in his life, he received a threat. He testified that prior to that time, he had never received a threat.
That's where I was going with it. Right. If it didn't matter if it was a text, could have yelled at him on the street, says, I'm going to kill you. That testimony would have come in.
If he yelled on the street the day or 3 days after that letter was intercepted, and he yelled at him, not I'm going to kill you, because he may have cut him off in the traffic. Mm-hmm. But as he did in this case, he yelled what the text messages said, which are, I'm going to insert language here, but I'm going to do something to you, you snitch, you explicative snitch, right? Showing that it's about his cooperation. If that yell talked about
but
Mr. Sandoval,
the only case he snitched though. This guy was an informant, wasn't he?
That's absolutely right, Your Honor.
But he got a bunch of. Well, did he not have a number of people who probably would like to get him for snitching?
But he had the testimony was he had never received a threat previously. And that he first received the threat 3 days.
It's the temporalness of this, or the timing of it, that helps your situation.
Absolutely. That we think gets it over this threshold for authenticity.
Had it been received a month later, a year later, it doesn't have the same significance.
Absolutely.
It's a three-day deal here.
If it had been even received a month later, or 6 months later, we think that would be far more attenuated than this very close time proximity. And
I'm having some difficulty. The reason I'm having difficulty is, now, do you represent that during that time period, he didn't have anybody else that he had been testifying against or had informed on during that 3 days? This is the only person?
I do not believe the record reflected whether he was cooperating during those 3 days. I honestly don't know whether the record reflects that or not, Your Honor.
If we accept it, my question is to the other side, if we accept it, that maybe this wasn't authenticated properly, what happens here? I mean, is that the evidence that supports the threats, or is there more?
There's much more. And in fact, the primary evidence of the threats is the letter that I just wrote to you, is Turan saying to Benitez, I am doing everything I can so that Luis can't testify. I sent a message for them to take care of Luis, to take care of him, to ensure that he did not testify. That is the primary evidence of the threat. That letter showing that he has attempted by sending a message, he's admitting here, I sent a message to my confederates to take care of Luis so that he cannot come testify against
him. The argument is that it's harmless.
Absolutely. And
even if it's not, it surely is harmless as to the murder for hire.
Absolutely. But I think it's certainly harmless as to the the obstruction and witness tampering charges because of this letter itself. And in fact, when the judge evaluating the motion for acquittal, the judge actually said, well, even putting these text messages aside, because there was lots of discussion about the text message during the motion for acquittal, as you might imagine. And the judge said, as the government agreed, putting the text messages aside, there's sufficient evidence based on the letter alone.
I asked Judge Gregory's question in this context. You got a text message just comes from the blue. You don't know where it comes from. You only know 3 days early there was a letter. Your guy's a snitch, so to speak, using the word informant or whatever.
Understand.
In the context of this. And he gets something from someone and says, you know, you've been a snitch. I'm, you know, going to offer you or whatever.
I mean, did you really need to go there?
Well, Your Honor, the benefit of hindsight is good. It's always easy after a conviction to say maybe.
I'm trying to help foresight.
I understand that, and sometimes we learn our lessons slowly. But I do think that in this context, Your Honor, what these text messages did and the reason they were offered, just to understand, is that they, in a sense, just corroborated what happened here. I mean, they were certainly not the vital piece of evidence. They corroborated what was in this letter that Mr. Turan had sent. And we thought and continue to think, as this court described in the Branch decision.
Probably just put them out there, didn't know if the trial judge would admit them or not. And in fact, he did admit them.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. I would never present something to a trial judge that I didn't personally believe should come in under the rules of evidence. But I think under the Branch decision, I think the judge's decision that this met that low threshold of authenticity that ultimately left it for the jury to make the determination. The defendants were free to argue that the connection, this circumstantial evidence, the sequence in time, combined with the content of those, the specifics about Mr. Sandoval's family, his mentally handicapped son, his daughter, and his wife, we think that when you combine those, that's within the wide latitude that this court ought to give district courts in evaluating authenticity objections. If there are no further questions, I thank you for your time and ask that you affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Richardson. Appreciate it. Mr. Kendrick?
Your Honor, with the court permission, Mr. Kendrick is seated this time to revoke the meeting response based upon the argument.
That's fine with us.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Y'all work it out however you like.
Thank you.
Your Honor, the focus of our rebuttal will be based upon the Mirandized or un-Mirandized statement presented to the court during the trial as it relates to Investigator Officer Duke's testimony when Mr. Turan was in transit from Houston to South Carolina. And Your Honors, I think you hit the nail on the head on this, that it was a very different scenario than that which was presented in Cooper and Connolly. Judge Wynn, you're absolutely right that those two individuals were in prison. And in fact, that's something that the court in the Fields case, the Supreme Court, addresses, that persons who are in prison have already been adjudicated, they've already been convicted, and then presumably they are more knowledgeable about what their rights are to remain silent and the like. In this situation, Mr. Turan was being transported before trial, before he had officially been charged, because he hadn't even been brought before a judge in South Carolina to receive the warrants. He was being transported from Houston to South Carolina.
Was there somehow an extradition hearing down there, or did he waive it?
He waived the hearing.
He waived extradition.
I believe so, yes, sir, Your Honor.
So they went down and picked him up.
Yes, sir. And Officer Dukes, as a part of that extradition team, testified that Mr. Tran was shackled at his hands and at his waist, but that he did not have his legs shackled.
He was flying commercially?
Yes, sir, Your Honor.
He had been incarcerated for about a month before that, correct?
Yes, sir.
But the theory of Miranda in terms of the custody is that the most people that people would be inclined to say and cooperate under circumstances where they're threatened with this sort of custody in terms of temporarily, that it's a change of condition.
Yes, sir.
But even though he's not an inmate, he's certainly under the same context of a person in custody with very little chance of being free. A whole month he's been in, he's waived extradition, he's going to be charged. So there's really no change in his condition that we normally look at in the theory of Miranda, is there?
Well, I would respectfully disagree, Your Honor, because I would submit that when you look at someone who is in prison, if you will, or in the local detention center, they don't have a guard with them at their side the entire time. They are not handcuffed the entire time. They are not shackled the entire time. They've got certain freedoms of movement, even though they're in a custodial environment as a part of being in a detention center or being in a prison. In Mr. Turan's situation, he was taken out of that. And
if you see many jails, prison make it looks like a hotel compared to what some of these city jails look like in terms of your custody. I mean, I'm not sure you have much more freedom just because of that. But the point is, you're in custody, and it really is no difference.
Well, Your Honor,
Go ahead.
I would just submit that when we're talking about freedom and the situations may be different, in the county jail, there may be overcrowding problems. They still have the restrictions upon their freedom, but they don't have that constant law enforcement present at their side the entire time. They're not shackled the entire time. There was a change in circumstances because Mr. Tran did have Officer Dukes there at his side the entire time. There was nowhere he could go. There was no way he could avoid the pressing of Investigator Dukes. And when we talk about the MS-13 comment, it wasn't an offhand comment. It was a situation where Investigator or Officer Dukes testified that he said to Mr. Tran, "I understand you're in a gang." Mr. Tran says, "No."
Well, I want to understand that. Difference with having the presence of the office from just plain old pre-trial detention. Someone is arrested, they're put in the county jail, and they're there for about 3 weeks.
Yes, sir.
As I would understand, if we follow the government's position, and in that instance, you can go in and talk to him then because you don't need to do Miranda because he's in custody. Is that the same analysis?
No. I would disagree respectfully with the government's position, Your Honor.
Now, I'm not saying they said that, but I'm saying that it seems like it would arise.
Well, I think that you still have to look at the circumstances surrounding the questioning, surrounding the interrogation. And there are, and I think even Conley and Cooper stand for the proposition, that if there has been a dramatic change in the circumstances, a change in...
The way I'm looking at this, trying to make sense of it, it looks like to me, Conley Cooper makes a lot of sense. The guy's in prison. That's his state of being.
Yes, sir.
I mean, if you put him in shackles, that's no different than what he does anyway. So it does make sense to go say, well, in custody, out of custody. But someone who has not been put in that state of being legally through adjudication is a different thing. And that's the differentiation I'm drawing here. This guy is being transported. As you said, he hasn't been charged. Nothing else is against him.
Yes, sir.
And that's like pretrial detention.
Yes, sir.
Why wouldn't Miranda apply in that instance?
I think it absolutely should. I think that you've got to tell the individual under that circumstance, because they have not been through the legal process before, that they have a right to remain silent. And I would just respectfully submit that...
Before you talk to them, you have to do that?
Especially about the crime which they have been committed.
Well, he just made a casual conversation. I thought that was the evidence.
Well, that's what he says, but this Investigator Dukes also testified that he was present on the crime scene and had knowledge about the case, and in fact, he was well aware of the fact that the government alleged that Martin Tran was MS-13, and that was specifically why he was asking the questions. And it's also important to note, and I see that I'm almost out of time, but I think it's also important to note that Officer Dukes doesn't turn this information over to anyone except for the FBI. Why else would he have turned it over? Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Milling. I note that Mr. Milling, you and Mr. Kendrick are both court-appointed in this matter, and we sincerely appreciate your work on behalf of your clients, and the court couldn't operate without folks like you all. We'll come down and greet counsel and take a short break.
We can discuss that. The honorable court will take a brief recess.